Welcome to Smart Healthcare Safety from ECRI, the most trusted voice in healthcare, committed to advancing effective evidence-based care. I'm your host, Paul Anderson, and for 15 years, I've overseen our risk management membership programs here at ECRI. Tens of thousands of healthcare leaders rely on us as an independent, trusted authority to improve the safety, quality, and cost-effectiveness of care across all healthcare settings worldwide. You can learn more about our unique capabilities to improve outcomes at www.ecri.org. Today, we're talking about strategies for combating physical and verbal violence against healthcare staff, one of the top 10 safety concerns identified by ECRI for 2023, and a focus of an upcoming Safety Sprint Collaborative from ECRI and the ISMP Patient Safety Organization. Our guests today are Karen Garvey, Vice President for Safety and Clinical Risk Management at Parkland Health, and J.D. Boucher, Workforce Safety Manager for Parkland Health. Can you tell us a little bit about Parkland Health, where you're located, what your patient population is, things like that?
Sure. Parkland Health is actually located in Dallas, Texas. We have a large uncompensated payer population, and we are the safety net for the Dallas County Hospital District. Our bed size is about 882, but we do, with capacity, have been challenged since COVID, since we opened our new hospital in 2015. Large behavioral health population. We are a very large trauma center, have one of the first burn civilian units that came into in northern Texas. Largest OB population with about 12 to 13,000 babies born a year. And just recently, we were published again in Becker's, being the busiest standalone ED in the nation. Roughly with about 210 visits prior to COVID, we were about 250 visits. And sometimes we will see over 800 people among all of our EDs within 24 hours. So we have a main emergency department, a psychiatric emergency department, an urgent care center, as well as an OB emergency department to be able to care for all of those individuals. Additionally, we are a hospital. We have several outlying clinics, the outpatient clinic systems, as well as the community-oriented primary care clinics. We also interface with some nursing homes within the Dallas County as well, and have licensors with them. One ambulatory surgery center, but that pretty much comprises our about 13,000 employee population here. And we are a large partner with the training program for UT Southwestern medical students, residents. We are the main training hospital here in Dallas.
Karen, if I may, we also provide care for all of our correctional health here in Dallas County. And I think last year alone, we had over 1 million visits in our clinics. So you can see the mass effectiveness that we have at Parkland and what we do for our county and counties surrounding us.
Right. And as J.D. mentioned, you know, for when it comes to the correctional health setting, the Dallas County Jail houses about 7,000 inmates, of which the staff there that are employed by Parkland, physicians are UT Southwestern, but the nursing staff that actually care for the patients in the infirmary intake, medical infirmary, psych infirmary, and then all the medication administrations as well. It's a big undertaking. And see violence in a whole different way there, too.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking, you know, with all those different emergency departments and all those different other settings, you know, non-hospital care settings and different patient populations, lots of opportunities where you could have both physical and verbal violence. But what made you sort of as an organization, as an entity, really focus in on workplace violence as a problem to tackle?
When I came here, there really wasn't a structured process of how to manage these events. We were also under a pretty heavy corporate integrity agreement at the time. And so there really wasn't a lot of bandwidth to focus on this area. Although I did partner with some individuals who also had an interest in it, one being the emergency medicine physician, and then one being the then head of the behavioral health area. So we actually put our heads together, looked at a charter, put a charter together, and provided a structure, and then pushed forward a multidisciplinary committee that was launched in 2015 and actually utilized an unfortunate case in the emergency department where a patient that was probably 6'6", 300 plus pounds, stark naked, that was just walking, running through the emergency department, pretty much taking out everybody in his path because he was so high on PCP. And just the injuries that you could see happening to the staff, whether they were physical or emotional, was really, really stark. But we utilized that video to really launch, to demonstrate what our employees are actually subject to. And so from that point on, we've continued to work on various projects and expand the committees as we get into some of the speaking points later on. We have focused areas of where there's more higher risk or there's a difference in the violence risk. But our workplace violence committee has continued to be in existence. It's continued to expand, and it's comprised of physicians, nurses, frontline, lab, operations folks, not just clinical, finance. If you think of this, you know, it's people that are not just clinically focused. And a large majority of our employees, about 50% of them, are people who are not clinical, but they do support the clinical operations, and they are also impacted as well. So we've expanded it beyond the clinical scope.
So, you know, you mentioned the committee. Let's talk about that a little bit more. What is the role of the committee? You mentioned its representation, but what's its basic function?
Its basic function is to really examine trends that are reported through our risk management information system, where we have four different types of events that are reported. And identifying and working with our partners, one group that I did not mention was our workers' compensation group. We work very closely with them and also with legal to examine, you know, who's getting hurt, when are they getting hurt, what kind of injuries are they sustaining. And then, looking to figure out where we have the greatest opportunity to make the most impact from the data perspective. What we do realize, though, it's not just data, but it's also providing the group information as to the status of our interventions, of where we're moving on. I'm delegating some of those responsibilities to individuals or even focus groups beyond the actual committee. And then, helping them help the organization. So for instance, as we went to make a change with one of the assessment tools in the ED and how individuals were assessed for the potential for violence, you know, getting that information up to the floors through the medical record, through handoff, again, through a visual sign, again, for our employees who are not in the clinical record, where they may have an opportunity to be harmed as well. So we expanded out. We also enlist our executives. I mean, that committee I talked about is the enterprise. We call it a Promoting a Safe Environment Committee, which is technically the Workplace Violence Committee. But we also, this last year, commissioned a Workplace Violence Executive Oversight Committee. So it bumps up to the COO, the Chief Nurse Executive, the Chief Medical Information Officer, the Chief Quality and Safety Officer, an SVP in Human Resources, Legal, and JD and myself, where they're seeing what we're seeing and that committee is seeing. Therefore, we can garner additional resources, but also be transparent. I think that they were stunned when we identified and reported that we know that employees that are here year one are most likely to be harmed, and we know what roles are being harmed as well. So we take that data and turn it into information that we can then action around.
So, I mean, it sounds like one of the most important functions of that committee is just organization-wide, staff-wide communication from the top level down to, you know, that person who just started last week, and whatever their role is. Have there been other benefits of having that structure around the program?
If we go to publish a policy, we want it to make sense to the front line and not publish a policy and saying, you know what, who did you talk to? And we have information on that, but it's bi-directional. You know, what are they seeing? What are they seeing if they go into hospitals where they may have relatives? You know, what signage are they seeing? Running information by the teams that is going to make sense, but also subliminally, it's also letting them know that we are doing something. Workplace violence, the engagement component from an employee and physician group is part of our strategic plan, where this is also a strategic priority that I drive with a work group here. So we're constantly being monitored, you know, on what we're doing. We also put together goals. We've developed a workplace violence plan, which has been required by the Texas House bills, of which the number keeps changing. It's now 112, where they delineate, and they've had this in place off and on since 2018. And so we took that very seriously and looked at all the elements that were required, but we also shared that with the committee. They want to know, you know, we want them to know what's expected of us and to also share that plan with them, so they know what our goals are for this year, which will be different from last year. I mean, even as we go to, increase and reevaluate the onboarding of or our annual training for workplace violence, we did a lot last year with enlisting a video with our executives on how important this was. You know, case studies, reporting is important for us to be able to know and to understand and trend and make change. This year, when we reevaluated it, we have to change the whole thing because we have put so many new practices in place since last year, which is a good thing. It's more work, but it's really a good benefit.
And also, I got to say, I think some of the things that are very successful in what we're doing now is with the interdisciplinary and interprofessional collaboration that we're doing, is giving all aspects of our workforce a voice to be able to strengthen what we're doing and the processes that we're establishing. And I think that's been a huge thing. And as Karen had mentioned, as we are getting ahead of what they're doing in legislation-wise for our states, House Bill 112 is for workplace violence for healthcare. Instead of just being in one focused area of the emergency department, is now going for all healthcare settings. And with that, we are trying to get ahead of the curve on this and already have implemented what that is into our healthcare system. So because we want to make sure that we maintain a key focus on the safety of our workforce here, but also we want to make sure that we're implementing it right. So we had key focus groups throughout the healthcare system that really helped give us the strength to create a great foundation that we can build on. And I think that was probably one of the big key successes that we had, is that we got a voice from all of the workforce when we were building this.
I want to come back to talk about state and even some federal regulation and legislation in a minute. But I want to pull on a thread you mentioned there, JD, which is, you know, some things that you found that have been successful, right? So are there other either interventions or, you know, you mentioned putting policies in place, things like that, that you found have been successful? And importantly, how do you know? What are your internal ways of knowing, like, yeah, this worked, or maybe this was a false start and we need to sort of recalibrate?
Well, I think that, and Karen's got to correct me on the name of this, but we have a council here, which is for our family and our visitors. And there's a specific name for it that it tends to leave my mind every once in a while, but I know their value is tremendous. We actually approached them first on what their buy-in for a workplace violence is, but we had new signage, updated signage. And they were looking at this stating, this language is not strong enough for the patient and visitor responsibility. They think that we should have approached it this way. And by implementing in their voice into our signage that is going to be patient facing, it really gave us a greater opportunity to see the needs of what they think it would be best suitable for our population. And so with that, it really gave us a great buy-in. And then on top of that, we also had 15 other focus groups throughout the system that really gave us a strong feed. So it may have taken a little bit longer to get the signage out because we got so much buy-in on it. I think the signage that we're putting out there now is very strong, and the message is not something that's going to have to change in a short period of time, because it really adds the responsibility of what that patient and visitor bring when they're here for healthcare. But also it gives them the opportunity to know that when they bring a disrupt to the environment, that there are actions that they're going to be held responsible for also.
Yeah, that committee is the Patient Family Advisory Council. And actually, it made me realize at one point in time that everything that we were doing was really internally focused, but realizing that we do have patients, we wanted to kind of get that voice. What does this look like from their point of view? And, you know, we were pleasantly surprised and kind of taken aback that we were too soft in what we were trying to convey. You know, when you look at what you see in the airports with the security now, and where they've had challenges, and they have signs when you are in line about fining if you kind of step out of line, we unfortunately can't do that. You know, we can't do the same in that we can eject you from our hospital and keep you out at the same time and fine you. They can do that in the airline industry. But we have moved in a direction where, you know, we've always been an open to our community view because of being the safety net. We take care of those who won't take care of them. And so, you know, knowing that, prior to COVID, we've had plans in place. During COVID, we saw a very, very few months where our workplace violence numbers really went down. And I for a second I had like a sigh of relief, and I was asking my colleagues across the country, if they were seeing the same thing, and they were, but reporting was down everywhere. And if you go back, 3 years ago now, these patients were critically ill. We were really struggling to figure out what was going on. And we weren't letting anybody in our doors. Right. So it made absolute sense. And so we then started to see these numbers climb, not only in number, but the aggressiveness. And again, I asked my colleagues, are you seeing the same thing? Yes, they were seeing it too. And now, as you look at society, the unfortunate incident, in Northern California last week on the mushroom farm where they're quoting workplace violence. It's outside of our industry, but it still demonstrates that there may be folks just in society that don't have strong, positive, adaptive behaviors with what's gone on in their lives during COVID. Don't know that for sure. But we have seen the numbers increase. We've seen the levels of aggression increase. And, we've been back in 2018, we had two major incidences that really brought this forward too, where we actually did a workplace violence campaign to let people know what we were doing. I had put in a grant to the Texas Workforce Studies, which was a nursing focused grant on obtaining personal alarms at that point in time. Have since gone back and gotten personal alarms for every employee through our Parkland Foundation. And they have, because, again, a lot of the tech systems of how you have these alarms that zero in on where you are do take a lot of money, and we don't have that capital to be able to do that. So this became the second best thing. But we had those two incidences, and what it also caused us to do was do a workplace violence campaign. What are we doing? And so we also drafted we talked about a certain case and what we were doing. We actually commissioned what we call life officers. So these are special, we have our own police force, but these are specialized officers who also have mental health training, and they're not dressed in a regular police uniform. They are armed, but they're in khakis and a polo. And they are individuals who can be commissioned to actually go up to the floors to interface with the staff and coach them in, support them, and the patients. And the patients do enjoy the conversations with them and trying to de-escalate them down. So we also, we brought those about. We have six positions. So that was an area that we also put a police depot on that unit because there was a high level of violence on, this was a surgical unit. Realizing that, many of the patients that we have are not just in the behavioral health areas or the ED, they have coexisting medical conditions that can't be managed in the behavioral health units. So they're out on the floors. And so those staff are a little bit more vulnerable because they haven't gone through the de-escalation training techniques, although they are now. Many of these leaders are having them do their staff do this because it's so prevalent now than what it was 4 or 5 years ago. But we did a root cause on one of these incidences and talked about it. And I think that we had a couple of WebExes where there were well over 1,000 employees just listening in, wanting to know what we were doing. We were very transparent, but out of that became a campaign. out of that became a communication tool from our chief nurse executive and our chief medical officer at the time on, we hear you, or these are all the things that we're doing. We want you to be able to understand what we're doing. And these are also things that are in the queue. And we have just resent that out within the last, 6 months or so, again, to give them an update on what's going on. So, you know, some of these other things that we've done have been risk assessments for focused areas. Our urgent care center, which is a section of the emergency department, but not physically connected, on how we do things there that may be different from the main ED. Our ambulatory surgery center, we focus a lot on that, our surgery center, and then also our correctional health setting, we do some focused work with them too, because when you think of the inmates and then the sheriff's office, some of the lateral bullying and violence that they may experience is going to be different than what we may see here at the main hospital in our clinic settings.
Well, another thing that we've done is we've actually done a workplace violence prevention plan for our whole system that sets goals yearly that we focus on, aside from our day-to-day activities of decreasing or preventing workplace violence. So it actually helps us to establish trends, establish benchmarks, and to give a keen focus. So one of the things that we're doing is the de-escalation recertification. We have a de-escalation program that we teach here at Parkland for our emergency department staff and our correctional health staff, and what they do that is the initial training is done at a full day, 8-hour process, and then the recertification once a year, just like your CPR. You need recertification to strengthen that agility, ability to react in a proper professional way to these abilities. But it's also a safety tool, probably one of the strongest safety tools we have, and that's one of our goals this year, is to increase our recertification. But we've also done third-party assessments for all of our healthcare system. And so, but we're also focusing on increasing our safety posts. We're looking at things that we can do that gives certain focus on those areas that we need to give a keen eye to, that we can really make sure that we're hearing the voice of our workforce. And those are the things that the executive committee down are focusing on, which we're real appreciative of.
Yeah, and in addition, you know, some of the things that we're also working on are we realized in the data reporting that there's a huge underreporting. When JD mentioned safety posts, those are our incident reports that come out of our risk management information system. So we know that if a patient escalates and they are, you know, the behavioral emergency response team, BERT, is called, and they're medicated, you know, they may trash the room, they may break equipment, they may physically harm one employee or a couple of employees, and they're likely verbally assaulting somebody too. We can only capture one of those events unless they put four different events in. So you know, it could be one, some, or all of those. So I'm actually working with our vendor, risk management information vendor, to change the how we can actually capture workplace violence events in that system. I mean, it'll benefit us, but it will benefit all of their client base as well, because we have built a lot of the more current, you know, racial slurs, gender issues that people, you know, comment on. Just some of the comments that are just so inappropriate. We've actually been able to capture those in the back end because we built that data in, and we want to be able to transfer that over to the newer system. But also because if you look at any event reporting system, W for workplace violence is going to end up at the end of the alphabet. So how do we put this first? You know, in one of the things that we can help the employee to get in quicker, faster, and make it easier for them. So that's something that we're working on right now, too.
Yeah. I also think another one of our successes that we've had is we took multiple policies that were governing our healthcare system. And we brought all of those policies down to three specific policies, one dealing with disruptive behavior, one dealing with workplace violence, and then the other is a new policy that we updated, which is preserving the environment of care. That is something that we introduced into our healthcare system. And with that, it also allows us to do a modification of services on patients, which a lot of healthcare systems are newly approaching this subject. So for us to go ahead and already integrate it into our system has been very beneficial on growing, and getting support from our entire workforce on this has been tremendous. Our reporting process is at least tripled, if not further, on since we've done this. It's only been about 2 months now, isn't it? So we have literally tripled, but we created an algorithm for workplace violence, disruptive behavior, and so forth. So they now understand the importance of the documentation system and how it should be done. They now understand that they need to verbally talk to the person and say that this is not okay. Workplace violence is not okay. And you talking to me that way is consistent with workplace violence. No longer are we a healthcare system nationwide that thinks that this is just part of our job. We now understand the importance of, and that we receive the respect and the partnership with our patient population when we are working in the healthcare system. But by creating this algorithm, we now have further steps, behavior warning letters, and then it goes on to modification of services. We actually will put behavioral alerts on the patient chart now. So that way, if they're not directly in the inpatient setting, on the outpatient setting, they're gonna be able to see it. And if we go to the termination, which we call a modification of services of a patient, we have a whole process of a multidisciplinary committee that was established by our chief medical officer and our chief nursing executive that oversees that committee, and Karen is the chair for that committee. And so we take actions all the way up to making it a virtual visit only, making it maybe moving their clinics, maybe having their medication mailed to them instead of them approaching a facility, or all the way up to termination from the healthcare system. With that, by law, you're only required in Texas for 2 weeks. We give them 30 days and we help them transition their care to another provider. So these are options that we've not had in place before that now, working with legal and CMS, that we've been able to do.
Yeah, the termination component is something that was really not supported by the leaders of our organization up until, I would say, within the last 6 to 9 months. And so as we created the policy that JD just mentioned, we also enlisted many of the front lines to look at this too, to give us feedback before we actually commissioned it and put it into practice. But now that it's been put into practice, we actually, before we even put it into practice, we had reached out to our CMS colleagues in the local area. I guess fortunately for us, we developed a positive relationship with our regulators during our corporate integrity agreement, and had reached out to them previously on a high utilizer case just to get some guidance on how we can actually manage these patients that keep coming to us when we've done everything that we can for them, or they refuse care for us to be able to facilitate care. So we did run this policy by them, you know, and in all due respect to them, they could not opine on the policy, but they said, go ahead. You know, and with seeing what was going on in the world and around them, you know, CMS had not released their document yet, but the Joint Commission had. And so we at least let them know that this was happening should any patients go calling them and complaining about us, which would launch us a surveyor to show up. So we at least preempted that, and haven't heard anything back since then, but you never know. But again, it's creating an awareness. And, you know, our leaders have said, we've always had an open door policy. We've always kept our an open face to the community, but realizing how the world has changed, we really need to close the doors and keep our staff safe. And that was information and feedback that was coming through surveys. They did not feel physically safe coming into our buildings. And that, you know, in my opinion, we've got to take care of our employees to make sure that they're safe to deliver good care. Mm-hmm. And if they're not feeling that way physically or psychologically, then we need to do a better job on that. So as JD had mentioned, we just had a third party risk assessment that looked at many of our buildings. And that was actually planned well before and scheduled well before the unfortunate incident that happened at our sister hospital here in Dallas. But there is a group that's reviewing those recommendations. I mean, and I also report to the board and have been for the last 5 or 6 years on workplace violence. And we continue to, JD and I continue to report up through them to give them information as to what we're doing, because this is on their hearts and minds too, as well as our executives. How do we keep our employees safe, especially in this environment?
So you've done a tremendous amount of work. But Karen, I want to sort of circle back to almost where we started. And, you said when you came into Parkland, this was an area that maybe didn't have a lot of structure. So if you're, talking to, and you're working in, a number of, like you said, a couple different nationwide advisory committees. So when you're talking to your peers who are maybe coming into that similar situation where they don't have a lot of structure, but given the national environment, they know they need to start paying more structured attention to this. What would each of you recommend as like, what's the starting point? Where should we go tomorrow? I can't fix this tomorrow, but where should I start?
I think you find the people who have the passion and you capitalize on that. People who have a drive to make change based on something that they're passionate about, they will make that change. And starting small, you don't have to, you can have a grand plan. This was not something that was well publicized in the organization. I knew that it was an issue. I'm a nurse by training. Having been involved in some of these situations as a bedside nurse or a manager, I get it. And, there were instances that would come up, but, in addition, finding those individuals who have a common drive, a common need to do this. We not only developed our workplace violence groups, but we also knew that we needed peer support. And so I also worked with a couple of other individuals, one being that behavioral health lead and one being a trauma psychologist. After the Dallas shootings that had occurred, we realized, and I knew coming in again from my last job, that we needed this. And so again, we didn't have the bandwidth to do anything. Therefore, we struggled. We got monies from our foundation and we actually were able to capitalize on some funds from them to bring Johns Hopkins in to grow that group too. So now we have a group of peer support, about 50 peer supporters across the health system. Again, where they're seeing and working to support their peers because of workplace violence related issues too. So again, it's finding the momentum, the passion, the support locally, starting small, and then you don't know where this will go.
I think one of the keys is finding out how to do it. So reaching out to organizations that have done this before, or national or international organizations. I'm just going to put like maybe ECRI or IHI, things of that aspect, and actually have this background knowledge, but do a literature review too, to find out what it takes to establish a prevention program in your healthcare setting. Because we know that they're not all massive level one trauma centers, but there are those small clinics that are saying these small physician offices and all that. They also need a plan for workplace violence prevention. And I think by reaching out and working in collaboration with these other institutions has probably been one of our strongest aspects, because we find out what their strengths are, how they built on it, and then ask for guidance. I think that's where it's something that we all kind of like, it's difficult to figure out where to start. These people have already started it, or they have the foundation. So build on that. And this is not something that people are keeping in their back pocket. They are offering this information because they have the same focus that we have. They want to make sure that people in healthcare are safe. We have a 50 to 60% higher rate of workplace violence than other professions. two nurses are getting attacked with workplace violence every minute of every day. And we're talking about two nurses getting attacked every minute. What about the other people in that healthcare setting? So those are the areas that we got to focus on. And then those, that's a collaboration. It's a nationwide, it's a global wide collaboration that needs to be done on this.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, sitting in the IHI group, I learned of, you know, people's job descriptions to create one that JD now is in, and I'm really thankful for, but it also is providing information to our executive suite to get them to understand the necessity, you know, budgets and things like that. You know, we've one of the things that we didn't mention that we have done too is in caring for our employees is we put together workplace violence care packages. That we send to them that have, you know, various items in them that we use from our Sparks peer support, but also resources and, you know better than I do what's in those because you put them together. But, you know, it with a personal note saying, you know, we're sorry that this happened to you. We want you to make sure that you take care of yourself. And these are some things that we're wrapping you in support in, you know, going forward.
We want to make sure that they're heard and understood. You know, I mean, when anybody goes through an incident, especially like that, and it makes you question, why am I being put into this situation? We want to make sure that they first know the support that we feel. It breaks our heart every time something happens to any of our workforce members. But we want to make sure that they know that we are doing everything we can. And by giving them the support factors that we got on there, within this care package, it also lets them feel the efforts that we're doing forward. So I think it's reinforcing the care and the support that we're doing on this, but also it just gives a human side to it instead of just a structured algorithm of leadership down. And I think once you humanize the workplace violence that's taking place, I think that's going to be a big step forward.
Yeah, and if they're in a position too where we can, you know, without re-traumatizing them, you know, enlist their support on how we can spread the information as to what we're doing, those are opportunities that we take advantage of, but we also assess the situation and not just tap into them if they're not able to, you know, help themselves. We're not gonna add extra pressure to them. You know, and it's also partnering with people in your organization. We work out of the Quality and Safety Operations Division, but it is partnering with our physician leads, our nursing leads. Our police folks are tremendous. We have our own police force here. They are awesome. Mm-hmm. Our trauma psychologists, our workers' compensation folks, our facilities folks from the physical plant perspective, our HR business partners too. We have revised some questioning on the exit interviews on if they're focused on workplace violence, you know, if they're leaving because of violence versus just the general cultural environment. So we're trying to garner some more information on those things. Then we've also in 2019, we worked with our HR business partners as well as our folks in our claims and legal area to create a workplace violence time off work policy. Because really, if you think about it, the way that we were charging was we were making people take PTO, their vacation time, when they were injured for these. Unlike, you know, if you actually had a bloodborne pathogen exposure or some other kind of back injury, you were off on workers' comp time. So we actually have that in our time and attendance, and we calculate that time too. So, but they also have, we've revised it over the years just because we, unfortunately, we saw some gaming in it initially in the first year. So we went back and looked at it. So they have to meet a certain criteria of the event report and then also be seen by a medical provider to be written off work, but they can take up to 3 days off, but they have to meet certain criteria for that.
JD, Karen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You can learn more about ECRI and the ISMP PSO from the ECRI website at www.ecri.org, where you'll find our 2023 Top 10 Patient Safety Concerns Report, which features a focus on physical and verbal violence against healthcare workers. You can learn more about Parkland Health at parklandhealth.org. be sure to subscribe to Smart Healthcare Safety on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to get our latest episodes. We welcome your feedback. Please visit us at ecri.org or email us at ecri-podcasts@ecri.org.